Welcome to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. Today, we continue our series of discussions about race and racism. This hour, we'll take a look at race, white privilege, and institutionalized racism in education along the Cape, the South Coast, the islands, and in Massachusetts. What's missing from public school art, English, and history classes? How do we educate the next generation about systemic racism and white privilege in our country? And how do we prepare teachers to facilitate these discussions among students? Joining us this hour is Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., Executive Director of the Privilege Institute and founder of the White Privilege Conference. He's also a speaker and educator. Dr. Moore, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Dr. Moore, I want to start our discussion by kind of taking a look at education from a high vantage point. What does the profession of teaching look like racially in the U.S. right now? Do black and brown students see themselves represented in our nation's teachers?
No, they don't. Depending on which research you look at, on average, I mean, the rounding off numbers, you're looking at about 80% of school teachers being white. And about 70 to 75% of them being white women. And so it is likely, it is possible that many students over the next 25 years, in fact, in the public school sector, depending on what state they're in, could experience an entire K-12 educational experience without seeing a teacher that looks like them.
And the student body across the U.S. has become more diverse. So why do you think the teaching profession has become more white and is dominated by women?
Yeah. I mean, you hit it on the head. Increasingly diverse. I mean, we're seeing communities, districts after districts. I mean, just in the last decade, many of them tilting towards more students of color than white students. And I think it's an ongoing struggle. It's an ongoing challenge about people of color in education. But let's just be clear that this has not always been the case. It's not that people of color have said, you know what, I don't want to be a teacher anymore, and therefore I'm going to leave the teaching profession. We got to this point through desegregation policies, because there was a vast majority of people of color in the teaching field. So I think the question we got to be asking is how we get them back. But part of your question about how we got here, some of it was legislation, you know, school closing. I mean, a big part of it due to some of the desegregation kinds of issues. And now I think we're just dealing with competition. You know, lots of times you see young kids, primarily girls, sometimes get into babysitting early. I've seen some folks talk about, you know, when you start babysitting early, it's almost like planting the seed for school teaching. And so that sometimes can be what sparks that young person's interest in working with kids, being a school teacher. And of course, you know, you can have parents, grandparents. So there could be a slew of things that keeps and brings white folks, particularly white women, white girls, into the interest of teaching. I don't think there's been much extensive study around that. But I do think this question about where are the people of color is one that's not about why aren't they there. The question should be about how can we get them back?
And I definitely want to talk more about that this hour. But in, as we kind of unpack this, it sounds like you're saying segregation is alive and is causing a lot of these problems, is kind of the example of systemic racism right there in our education system. But there's also some cultural factors as well driving some, as you said, young white women into the profession with, you know, good hearts and good minds. But it's also kind of contributing to segregation, right?
Yes. I think the question about why so many white teachers has to be connected to desegregation, segregation policy. the essentially wiping away of schools and educational opportunities for Black students by really opening up the floodgates, so to speak, in reference to desegregation. Because what happens is those many of those teachers, those Black teachers, specifically those teachers of color, were not retained because not only segregation, but white supremacy, white parents, white families saying, I don't want my kid being taught by that, I'll put it kindly, colored person.
Mm.
So I just think it's really important as we look at where we are now and looking back on that, most people ask, how can we get more people of color into teaching,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to asking, how do we get them back? Because by asking the latter, then you begin to understand this real, essentially, cleansing that happened, as I refer to it, when it comes to the teacher education program, the teacher education access. And so now we're almost like running uphill that's got water pouring down it, oil pouring down. It's just really a difficult task that's ahead. In fact, the research is showing that, particularly in reference to Black males, we may be looking at the next 10 years actually a number that's decreasing in reference to Black males coming into education, into teacher education. Now, that's not to say folks aren't making great efforts, making great strides, but it's just the sheer numbers of that, which I think puts us in a position of asking, can white teachers do this job?
Mm.
Can we? Are we preparing them properly? Are we requiring them properly? And so are we providing them the professional, personal development to, you know, continue to evolve to do this? I think these are the questions as we look at the next 25 years that we need to be asking in the educational realm.
Mm. I think it's interesting that you point out how important language is as we kind of grapple with the education profession and what it means for our children as they grow up through the system, saying that it's not that we need to entice people of color to come into the profession. They were there. And that's understanding how complex, as you say, segregation and desegregation is. And also, I think highlighting that we think of those sometimes, I think, in historic terms as if they happened in the past. But in fact, it's happening today. It's an active issue that educators are grappling with.
Yes, yes. And I think because we have somewhat been erroneous in the teacher recruitment efforts, I'll just focus on that because that's a place where I've got real interest and had some experience. And by erroneous, I mean people looking at it as if we're trying to attract people into this profession as opposed to getting them back, that we end up, again, almost like that gear on the 10-speed bike that keeps skipping and catching track and skipping. And so it's almost like we'll sputter a little bit forward and sputter three steps back. And I think for me, what I'm saying to schools and school districts, it's twofold. Number one, listen, you may not get many teachers of color these next 10 years into the school building. And not that we don't try, but the reality is Amazon, Netflix, I mean, some of the competition that's out there now wasn't there 25 years ago, 50 years ago when it came to teaching and teaching options for or options versus teaching when it came to people of color. So now the competition is intense.
Mm.
And so I think the question is now, is competence, skills, and white folks.
Mm-hmm.
And can we prepare teachers, white teachers primarily, to do this job in a competent way?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just for kids of color. I mean, we have to produce another generation of white students who have a broader, more open, more belonging, more inclusive mindset. And I think that it's really important that we don't turn the focus of school teaching and white teachers solely on kids of color, but we also got to bring in some of the gaps that are missing from white students that are going through this process as well.
And that's something I wanted to ask you. The Cape and the Islands specifically are majority white. And so when you think about how you might work with teachers, say, in an area like this, white, mainly white teachers with a lot of white students, how do you help those teachers? What are some of the first things you might say to a group of teachers to help them start to, you know, learn that they need to grapple with this in an ongoing way?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you ask that, because if you would ask me this, you know, a year ago, you know, the hurdle for getting them embarking and engaged around this subject matter may have been a bit more difficult than it is today. Mm-hmm. But let's just say, all of that to say that even today, the place I would start is community, workforce, and leadership. I mean, meaning that our communities are changing. And even in the Cape, I mean, you're somewhat living in a zootopia there in reference to what is going on. I mean, it's just not the real world when you look around in many other cities and many other communities. I mean, the world is changing. America is changing. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to have our kids ready for those changes. And secondly, the workforce, the workplace. I mean, not only is the workplace changing, but the research is showing that when people want to solve big problems, diversity in the workplace assists in that. That monocultural, monolithic environments are limiting and tackling complex issues. And then lastly, leadership. I think, I mean, even the opportunities, the possibilities in reference to the ongoing complexities, the ongoing challenges our society will be experiencing, it's going to need a new wave of leadership. And I think education is one place that we have a real opportunity to, as a school teacher, as a coach, as a counselor, as an administrator. I mean, education has proven time and time again, what you say to a third grader could impact them all the way to their grave. Mm-hmm. It can inspire them. It can inform them. And I think I never lose sight. And that's why I always say to people, I'm a school teacher. I'm a coach. That's my core. And I take pride in that, because what we say to young people at 13, at 5, literally can last them, inspire them for a lifetime. And I just love the possibility of that in that job. Mm. And that's what I'm saying to teachers, to really empower them and inspire them to realize the abilities that we possess standing in front of 25, 30, 40 kids. I mean, we literally have the power to change the world.
Mm. And it really requires, it sounds like you're saying, expanding both the teacher's worldview to understand that this doesn't, as you say, just matter to people of color, but that it in fact matters to all Americans, and then trying to impart that on students. And I guess, is it ever too early to start talking about race and privilege with a child?
No. I mean, I have a 3-year-old right now asking for stuff, saying I want stuff. Got more stuff than she needs laying around already. And so she may not comprehend completely the lessons we're trying to give her. But what I've learned working with young people, it's really just about consistency. You know, a real repetitive effort, positive reinforcement, and most importantly, role modeling. Mm-hmm. And so I think you have to be careful content-wise. You know, I'm not talking to her about, you know, white supremacy, so to speak, white supremacists, because those are concepts that, you know, are way beyond where she is at this moment. But it's not that we're adjusting that conversation, though, when she's around, because we do want her to see engagement around that subject matter. But when it comes to her, it's about, do you really need all this stuff? Can we help somebody else out? I mean, why are you so having such a difficult time letting this go when you have something that can replace that? I think for a 3-year-old, in my mind, in our believe that's the beginning conversations of gratitude, of patience, of privilege, all, you know, components, all segments. When you're talking about this topic, you don't just talk about white supremacy or mm-hmm. white privilege. It should be in relationship with other things, and that's got to be the strategy. And if that's the strategy, it's not too early to start, even at three.
Right. So laying that foundation and then building up the context and the concepts as that child gets older and goes through the education system. We are up against a break. We're talking with Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., Executive Director of the Privilege Institute. When we come back, we'll hear about some local efforts to combat racism and to teach students about white privilege. We'll be back. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident in for Mindy Todd, and today we're talking about racism and white privilege in education. And with us this morning is Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., a speaker, an educator, and executive director of the Privilege Institute. Also joining us right now on the phone is Dr. Meg Mayo Brown, superintendent of the Barnstable School District. Good morning, Dr. Mayo Brown.
Good morning. Pleasure to be on with you, and just so delighted to be able to hear Dr. Eddie Moore and his comments this morning.
Well, Dr. Mayo Brown, you're considering some changes in Barnstable schools. I wanted to ask you first, are these issues you had been thinking about prior to the racial reckoning that we've been undergoing in our country over the past month or so?
Yes, most definitely. I'm relatively new to the Cape. I'm in my fourth year in position as superintendent here. And when I arrived into Barnstable, I noticed, you know, part of my entry plan was taking a look at the data, sort of, you know, having conversations with educators and community members. And I think what I observed or jumped out at me at the time was no one was talking about race. It was sort of a culture of colored blindness, if you will. And when you look at our data, when you looked at the data 4 years ago, there were these sort of glaring achievement gaps between white students and our students of color. There was disproportionality in terms of students who were referred to special education and those that are in special education in terms of, as a student of color, you were more likely to be placed in special education. And then the third area was our discipline data. Again, students of color had disproportionate rates of discipline action and suspensions. So taking a look at all of this data, I presented to the school committee and to, you know, our district leaders and school leaders, like, let's look at this data. We need to have some very sort of open and transparent conversations about what the data is telling us. So the work, I would say, started, you know, three or four years ago. At this point in time, I'm very grateful that we received a letter from an organization called BHS for Change, that those kinds of communication from our students, from our community, only now help us accelerate and amplify this work on equity. And so, you know, I have to say that I'm thinking about this work as a white woman of privilege, right? So you need to say that. And so I'm always checking my thinking as I sort of think about the framework of what we need to do as a district in nine schools. And I think the work is very parallel. It's not linear. So we need to sort of do some internal personal work. You know, as white people, we have a lot of work to do. And in Barnstable, probably 98% of our staff are white. So we need to understand our own white privilege. We need to understand what microaggressions are. We need to identify, you know, our instructional practices, as I mentioned before, that lead to inequity, right? So there's this sort of personal journey that each of us needs to be on. Combined with that, we need to build our racial literacy, right? Mm-hmm. We need to have this language to be able to talk about race, both as adults and students. We need to make changes in our curriculum, right? We can help build the understanding of oppression and culture and white supremacy by taking a look at our curriculum. And I would just say, as an aside, when we look at our English language arts curriculum at the high school level, we just did an audit, 85% of what students are reading were written by white Anglo-Saxon men, as an example. And then the fourth area is culturally responsive teaching, right? we need to be able to adjust our instructional practices and look at our institutional practices to make sure that all students are achieving and that we can eliminate this unacceptable achievement gap that we have between white students and our students of color.
It sounds like what you're saying is what Dr. Moore and I were just talking about, in that it's curriculum, of course, but then there's cultural things that need to be addressed as well. And when it comes to teachers, you know, you said 98% of the teaching staff in the Barnstable District is white. What are you going to do to help equip them to have some of these conversations, which can be tough, but then also to turn back to their students and guide their students?
Right. So I think, you know, initially it's the our educators have to do this personal journey first. And we've got probably about 150 teachers who have opted in to doing a book club with White Fragility. That's a good starting point, right? So, you know, as I read that book.
And that's a book by Robin DiAngelo. It's called White Fragility.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. And so I think it helps us, again, as white people sort of see our role and understand the history of oppression in a way that we were not taught about in school, in a way that we were not taught about in teacher education or preparation programs. So I think allowing people to do some of that internal work over the summer is a good place to start. Mm-hmm. I think understanding, helping our educators understand what microaggressions are, implicit bias, are all good starting points. So I think my point is you can't just do one thing, right? It has to be, again, this very integrated approach. And we have to get our educators, you know, I think Dr. Moore used the term competent. You know, how can we prepare our white teachers to do this work in a very competent way? And, you know, some teachers have said, can we just, you know, have some professional development? Yep, we can certainly do some professional development, but that's not going to necessarily change the outcomes for our students of color unless we approach this through a very comprehensive way of looking at both our where we sit in our own culture, building racial literacy, adjusting our curriculum, and giving teachers the professional knowledge base and skill set around culturally responsive teaching so that, again, we can eliminate these achievement gaps that we have.
And I would say with this letter that you mentioned from a group of students, so it was a group of students wrote this letter to the school district, and it was a very detailed multi-page letter with a lot of suggestions and ideas. So it doesn't just say fix the problem, it actually tries to help guide you and other educators. And more than 1,100 alumni signed that. So it sounds to me that there is an appetite with the student body or recently graduated students who are looking and saying, I'm missing something here.
I agree. And I think, you know, certainly the letter provides us with some very concrete steps, as you say, coming from our students and recent graduates, that and student voice, the young voice, is so important in having these conversations and rethinking and reframing what we do in school. So I was very appreciative to receive that letter. You know, I've responded to that letter with my own letter back to them saying, I stand with them. We will implement these, you know, certainly for what I have authority over, which is, you know, school committee has a level of authority, superintendents have a level of authority, but in terms of curriculum, professional development, certainly the school committee is going to look at issues such as the mascot, as well as perhaps some graduation requirements. You know, should, you know, the students had asked, you know, could we consider having Black history as a local graduation requirement? So we're certainly, you know, certainly going to be having conversations about that as well.
Mm. And the mascot, just to mention, is it's the Barnstable Red Raiders, right? It's a Native American is the mascot. And is there talks about changing that mascot?
There is. Certainly, Pat Clark, who's our Barnstable High School principal, is engaging in those conversations with his faculty and staff and parents. the school committee is meeting next week. I anticipate that they're going to initiate a larger community conversation around the mascot. You know, the mascot over time has been sort of raised and then fallen aside in terms of taking any steps with that. But I think, again, you know, with enough community sort of input around it, and that the time is now to take a look at the mascot. Mm-hmm. Just from my own personal standpoint, the mascot is not inclusive. I think the time has come to change it, but the community had to be ready to have this conversation to talk about what should the mascot be to represent that Barnesville High School is an inclusive community.
You mentioned changing the curriculum as one of the prongs toward that you're thinking about in trying to kind of make some deep changes at Barnesville High School. But it does make me wonder, with state requirements, and we are going to be speaking with somebody from the State Education Department a little later in the show, but from your vantage point as a superintendent, how do you try to expand the curriculum to be more inclusive when you're up against things like standardized tests, the MCAS test?
Well, at least in Massachusetts, the state gives local districts the flexibility to develop and implement our own curriculum. Obviously, there are learning standards through the Massachusetts curriculum frameworks that guide our work. And I think, you know, as you look at those learning standards, you'll see some of this in that. And it's really up to districts in terms of what our program of studies looks like and how we design courses that address the curriculum frameworks at the state level, but also incorporate areas that are important to the local community. So I don't anticipate that there's going to be sort of any disconnect with the state as we do this work in Barnesville.
Mm. And Dr. Moore, I want to talk a little bit more about curriculum from your vantage point, kind of on a national level. And you think about, you know, in Massachusetts, you know, Dr. Mayor Brown was just saying there's a little bit of flexibility, and that's a good thing, right? That's allowing for some openness. But then again, how do you kind of select and choose appropriate works and concepts to introduce to students that are more inclusive?
Yes. Those are good questions. First morning, Superintendent Mayor Brown, good to be on with you. I'm thinking that, you know, what I'm advising people on when it comes to curriculum, because it's such a tough thing. Not only is it, as you mentioned, you know, sometimes in the structure of policy, you know, people have grown fond and familiar with the content that they're teaching. Sometimes one of the hardest things you can, you know, kind of pry out of the hands of the educator, of the teacher. And so I think, you know, the thing I'm trying to do is showing the research, showing the data around the harm, the impact, the injury, the trauma, in fact, inflicted upon people when they don't see themselves in the curriculum, or if they see themselves represented around the organization, around the school in a harmful way. And I don't think we would put up with that around gender. I would hope not. And I don't think we would put up with that around some other kinds of religion. And I think that this is the approach that I'm taking in reference to talking about it from an injurious standpoint. And not just kids of color, mm-hmm. also white kids get injured if all they learn is white. And so by starting with that data, starting with that kind of injurious approach, then presenting many, many, many resources. And actually, there's a framework right now in the school, a multicultural education kind of calendar, and we could start there and really start with little things or little steps. I mean, I'm open to meeting people where they are and working with people at the pace that they are comfortable. But the bottom line is this is not an option anymore. Like, America's changing. The world is changing. We have to get our kids. We need to change. And I think that's my greatest frustration right now with education, with teacher education especially, is that, as you mentioned earlier, we were talking earlier about the data, right? Superintendent Mayo Brown,
yes.
mentioned the data, right? I've been visiting schools around the Blackboard project that we did, and school districts have been operating way below average. I'm talking 60%, 50% four-year graduation rate for black boys. And not only are people not losing their jobs, sometimes people are even getting promoted in the district. Like, there is no consequence to the destruction of black genius, brown genius, people of color, young people in the K-12 system right now. And I think that I'm not a big cancel culture kind of guy. I'm not saying if you do this, you're done. I'm just saying if you do it for 10 years, though, we might have to reconsider if this is the district for you, because we're not wanting numbers to go down. We want them to go up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's time to have some consequences in the conversation about moving forward.
Mm, accountability there. And also teaching, as you say, not just teaching these concepts aimed at black and brown students, but including white students, and increasing their resiliency so that these conversations aren't as hard. As you mentioned, we don't have these problems necessarily with gender being displayed inappropriately in schools. And so why, when we come to race, can it be so much harder? I want to take a call right now. Mathea More from the Martha's Vineyard Charter School has joined in. Good morning. Thanks for your call.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
What's on your mind?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, I'm really glad to be hearing all the things that Dr. Moore and Dr. Mayo Brown have been saying. I'm really pleased to hear about the work that they're doing in Barnstable that she's, you know, been initiating for years. I think it's something that every school should be doing and should have been doing. If they haven't already, they should absolutely be doing it now. This is, you know, not something necessarily for me that has been new to what I've been trying to bring to my classroom. It was pretty much why I became a teacher. But I think is really important, and what Dr. Brown and Dr. Moore have both been talking about, is that our white children are absolutely impacted by having misrepresentations in the culture of their education. And so, you know, I think that black and brown families are at the table, and it's bringing the white families to the table. And sometimes that means having them understand their own skin in the game, and realizing the ways in which those children are negatively impacted by being abandoned to a white supremacist curriculum.
And thank you for that. Yeah, and it's I think what we've been hearing in the national conversation, which is that it's time for many white people to do the work, and that and to come join, as you say, join the table, and that's the only way that we can really tackle some of these deeply entrenched issues.
Yeah, well, someone recently talked about, you know, the anti-smoking campaign, and how for years and years and years, we couldn't figure out how to get people to stop smoking. And it wasn't until we got the non-smokers starting to understand how their health was impacted by the smokers. And then, only then, when people realized their own health, and I wish it wasn't this way, I wish as humans we didn't operate this way, but it was only when people who didn't make the choice to smoke realized that their health was being impacted that they started to support these anti-smoking measures. And we really have to get there with racism.
We do. And thank you for your call. We appreciate that. We need to go to a quick break, but stay with us. We're talking about race and privilege and education, and we will be considering more voices when we return. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. And joining us this hour is Dr. Eddie Moore, Jr., Executive Director of the Privilege Institute and founder of the White Privilege Conference. And also on the line with us is Dr. Mayo Brown from the Barnstable School District. I want to take a call now from Lisa Brown, calling in from Nauset High School. Good morning, Lisa. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, everybody. It's great to be here.
And you teach a social justice class at Nauset. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. First, I wanted to give a shout out to Eddie Moore. Hi, Eddie. It's great to hear you again. We hosted a white privilege symposium in 2017 here at Nauset. And though we didn't have the attendance that we were hoping, Barbara Burgo and I put it together with a host of other folks. We had a stellar cast of characters come into Nauset. We had Debbie Irving and Jackie Batalura and Peggy McIntosh, you know, unpacking the white privilege knapsack, et cetera, et cetera. And I've been teaching classes called Exploring and Respecting Differences. This is my 22nd or 23rd year at Nauset. I'm also an alumni. Is it a social justice class? Yes, it's in part a social justice class, but it's also kind of a precursor to the social emotional learning stuff that we have been sort of really pushing in the state of Massachusetts of late due to rising anxiety and other sort of personal issues. The way that I approach everything in my classes, and they're obviously predominantly white, we have about 15% of the quote-unquote minority population at Nauset, is through a really personal lens. And one of the things that that Dr. Moore...
Oh, Lisa, it's a little difficult to hear you. It's a little tough to hear you, but yeah. One of the concepts that you talk about in your class?
Is equal rights for others does not mean fewer rights for you. It's not pie.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that on an interpersonal level, it is really, really important that kids understand that they can come from a place of love or a place of fear, and that personal behavior, personal morals, values, and ethics, personal introspection, and building that toolbox from as young an age as possible helps to create equity on a bottom line across the board, and we have to teach that way. Our curriculums have to reflect that. Our interpersonal relationships with our students have to reflect that, and our collegiality between our colleagues have to reflect that.
Yeah, and I think it's an important thing to consider as we talk about some big structural issues, and that can be overwhelming, is that we can start by our own personal self and our own personal world. How receptive are your students to concepts like this?
Kids vote with their feet. And what I mean by that is that I've never not had a full class of kids. Kids are naturally at this age kind of narcissistic. They're kind of hungry to really understand themselves in relation to the bigger world around them. And so to start out with things like stereotyping and to talk about what happens in our school setting and then to branch out regionally, locally, and then nationally and statewide, kids, I sometimes have waiting lists to get kids into my class. And that's really important because we're projects-based. I don't do homework, but kids go out into their communities and end up doing their own homework and then coming back into class and sharing it. And then I have three sections of this class. So by the third section, which is the honors section, kids are wanting to get to the state house to actually legislate for the changes that they see need to happen on a personal level.
Hmm. Well, thank you for calling in to talk about what you're working on and the power that kids, when they're motivated, can have to not just change their own behavior, but to maybe enact some bigger changes.
Yeah, and I just want to do a little infomercial. If any school system wants to plug in the White Privilege Institute and Dr. Eddie Moore, I highly suggest it. It was eye-opening for us, and we would love to have him back. So, again, thanks, Eddie.
I want to bring a voice from the state into this conversation now. Joining us is Ventura Rodriguez, Senior Associate Commissioner at the Massachusetts Department of Early and Secondary Education. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Dr. Rodriguez.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I hope you've been able to listen in a little bit as we've been trying to kind of touch upon some various pillars as we unpack institutionalized racism and our own behavior as well. There's been a lot of talk on the Cape about racism and white privilege in the last few weeks. Is the state's education department considering any changes to the curriculum or the standards to more accurately reflect Black and Indigenous history and to encourage conversation about white privilege?
Yeah, well, again, thanks very much for inviting me. I would love, I'll say it now, to follow up at some point to continue to speak, because there's a lot that I'd love to share. I'd say the first thing is that I'm getting a slight echo. Are you hearing it on your end?
No, you sound a little far away, but you're clear.
Okay, great. So, you know, I will say, since our commissioner, Jeff Riley, came in about 2 years ago, you know, he's really been explicit about the fact that even though Massachusetts is lauded as being the number one education state in the country, when we look at our data, we're not the number one education state for all of our kids. And we look at the data specifically, and we've been talking about this for years, when we look at African-American, Latinx students, you know, language learners, students living in poverty, special ed students. So we've been actively working for at least a few years to really ensure that we're coming up with explicit strategies to better serve all kids, and particularly students of color. Mm. You know, one thing I'll highlight is Dr. Mayo Brown, first of all, talked about the frameworks that we have. And, you know, I'd say we're always open and looking to improve. It is true that in Massachusetts, a lot of local decisions that guide the implementation of frameworks and choices around curricula. We do have, as one of our guiding principles in the current social studies framework, something that talks about explicitly that, you know, curricula should be built on ensuring that they incorporate diverse perspectives and acknowledge perceptions of events affected by race, ethnicity, culture, religion, you know, and sort of go on. So we put those frameworks out there. Now, you know, can we do a better job of supporting, encouraging, sometimes like pushing or nudging our districts a little bit more to ensure that the curricula actually reflects, you know, all student voices, and particularly a lens on race and racism? Absolutely. I'd say a couple of things that we're doing and have been doing. I think first off, we acknowledge that you know, institutional racism cuts across all segments of society, including, you know, government systems. And the governor himself has said this in statements. So what we've been doing actually, you know, starting over the last couple of years, is doing training for our staff. And we're continuing that work where we're training all of our staff with a group called Overcoming Racism to make sure that our staff are grounded in common understanding, knowledge, principles about what we mean when we say anti-racism, and what it means to work towards becoming an anti-racist organization. But I think for us, it's important to try to address hearts and minds, but honestly, more important is to make sure that our practice, our policies are actually reflecting and helping us get to the goals that we have, which is that, you know, serving all kids in the Commonwealth well. And then the final thing I'll say, there's a lot to talk about, but
there is
great efforts around educator diversification. And we have a number of initiatives that we've been leading, looking at diversifying the educator workforce with districts, our superintendent workforce as well. Like in Massachusetts, we've been stuck at around 4% of system leaders, you know, district leaders being people of color, which again, we have a program that's looking to train and place the next cadre of diverse superintendents, because we also feel like, you know, leadership matters. And we have Dr. Mayo Brown. And when you have a superintendent like that who places his front and center, we think that really matters. We think that that has to be a part of the training that we're providing our superintendents. And we also think that we need to diversify by race and ethnicity, the superintendent ranks as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's something we talked about with Dr. Moore at the beginning of the show, how right now the majority, as you're saying, of the workforce is white, and that to change that, it could take a generation. And so do you have pieces in place for teachers, maybe white teachers, who to try to push them to confront these things and to actually, you know, enact or put in place some of the standards or the suggestions that you have curriculum-wise?
Sure, we do. I answer that in a few ways. One is we offer what we call academies through the department, where we provide training for school and district teams. And we're continuing this work. We've actually just launched two new academies that I think are already oversubscribed. So we're trying to expand, access. One is focused specifically on supporting school and district teams around culturally responsive pedagogy. Mm-hmm. And the second is focused specifically on the district and school systems themselves and how to sort of critically examine them and redesign them to support equity and racial equity specifically. We also have a variety of programs. I'll highlight one where we have a teacher diversification grant. This is actually the year three of this grant. It's loosely about $2 million every year of the pilot. And we partner with districts and provide funding. And the main strategies in the short term they've been doing is identifying paraprofessionals who tend to be much more racially reflective of student populations. And through the funding we provided, they identify those folks and then pay for their enrollment and completion in educator preparation programs, mm-hmm. and also fees related to either taking licensure exams or, preparing for licensure exams. And so, again, we're entering year three of that program. But I think what we're working on, what we found in Massachusetts is that even though 22% of our college students are Black, Hispanic, or Asian, only 10% are actually sort of taking that first step to becoming teachers in the sense of, taking the initial licensure exam. So what we're contending is that we have to provide opportunities to address both real financial barriers to enter the profession. What Dr. Moore was talking about earlier as well, other opportunities that may exist, in other professions that we're competing against. And I think the big thing that we're tackling is the reality is that we have our next teachers of color in seats right now in Massachusetts schools.
That's
but
right.
Not all of them are having experiences that make them say, you know what, I want to be a teacher.
Right. So, yeah.
The challenge right now is how do we ensure that our students of color, all our students, I agree, but our students of color and our current staff of color who we want to retain, that we're addressing their experience, because the issue of retention is just as important, if not more so at times, for our current educators. So one of the things I'll preview is we're trying to design a statewide scholarship right now that would be available to undergraduate students, mm-hmm. In addition to some of the financial incentives we already have. Because, again, we think there are real financial barriers as one of the barriers, one of the challenges that, quite frankly, we have to address.
Well, thank you. And I know we just scratched the surface here, and we are running out of time. Dr. Rodriguez of the State Department of Education, we so appreciate you coming on just to highlight a few things. We have just a few seconds left. Dr. Moore, I know you've been working on these issues for a long time. Do you feel like there is a sense that some lasting change will happen in this round of racial reckoning we're seeing in our country?
Shout out, Sister Lisa Brown. Appreciate you, Dr. Rodriguez. Mayo Brown, appreciate y'all. Let me say this, Catherine. I like to say I'm pistemistic, which means I'm okay with believing things are going to get better as long as there's action. Now, listening to Brother Rodriguez lay out some real substantive examples, Sister Mayo Brown lay out some real goals, some real initiatives associated with this topic, I think allows me to feel a breath of optimism because there's action behind it.
Well,
but
thank
I
you.
Think as we look at this horizon, that the thing I'm encouraging people is let's not forget what got us here, that
yes.
people lost their lives. And that's what I want to be able to look back on this time and say, that I don't know how much I was able to do, but I was doing something.
Thank you.
Some young people lost their life.
Thank you. And that is Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., Executive Director of the Privilege Institute. And I want to thank Dr. Meg Mayo Brown, Superintendent of Barnstable Schools, and Ventura Rodriguez, Senior Associate Commissioner at the Massachusetts Department of Early and Secondary Education. And I want to thank you for listening. We will have more of these discussions. We just scratched the surface. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd.